Chapter 2. January is midsummer in Antarctica, and days are long with only an hour or two of twilight. Temperatures on the peninsula can reach as high as 15 degrees Celsius, 59 degrees Fahrenheit. But since the tour group had come ashore, it had dropped to freezing. At the scheduled time for the Polar Queen to return, there was neither word nor sign of her. Maeve continued her futile attempts to make contact every half-hour until 11 o'clock in the evening. As the polar sun dipped toward the horizon, she stopped hailing on the ship's channel to conserve the transmitter's batteries. The portable radio's range was limited to 10 kilometers, and no other ship or passing aircraft was within 500 kilometers of picking up her calls for help. The nearest source of relief was the Argentinian research station on the other end of the island, but unless freak atmospheric conditions stretched her signals, they would not have received them either. In frustration, she gave up and planned to try again later. Where was the ship and crew, she wondered constantly. Was it possible they had encountered the same murderous phenomenon and suffered harm? She did not wish to dwell on pessimistic thoughts. For the time being, she and her party were secure. But without food or bedding for warmth, she did not see how they could hold out very long. A few days at most. The ages of her excursion group were on the high side. The youngest couple were in their late 60s, while the rest ranged through the 70s to the oldest, a woman of 83 who wanted a taste of adventure before she went into a nursing home. A sense of hopelessness welled inside Maeve. She noted with no small apprehension that dark clouds were beginning to drift in across the sea from the west, the vanguard of the storm that First Officer Trevor Haynes had warned Maeve to expect. She had enough experience with South Polar weather conditions to know that coastal storms would be accompanied by fierce winds and blinding sleet. Little or no snow would fall. Debilitating wind chill would be the primary danger. Maeve finally gave up hope of seeing the ship any time soon, and began to plan for the worst by making preparations for the excursion members to bed down for the next 10 hours. The still-standing huts and rendering shed were pretty well open to the elements. The roofs had caved in long ago, and high winds had broken the few windows, as well as carrying off the doors. She decided her group would stand a better chance of surviving the bitter cold and life-threatening wind by remaining in the cavern. A fire using a stack of weathered lumber at the whaling station was a possibility, but it would have to be placed near the entrance. Farther back in the cave, and the smoke could cause asphyxiation. 4 of the younger men helped her place the bodies of the 2 women and crewmen in the rendering shed. They also pulled the Zodiac farther ashore and tied it down to prevent it from being blown inland by the increasing winds. Next, they sealed all but a small opening of the tunnel entrance with rocks to minimize any frigid gusts that might sweep through into the cavern. She did not want to seal them off completely from the outside by closing the rock door. Then she gathered everyone around and ordered them to huddle together for mutual warmth. There was nothing left to do, and the hours of waiting for rescue seemed like an eternity. They tried to sleep, but found it all but impossible. The numbing cold slowly began to penetrate their clothing, and the wind outside turned into a gale that shrieked like a banshee through the air hole in the stone barrier they directed at the tunnel entrance. Only 1 or 2 complained. Most bore the ordeal stoically. Some were actually excited at experiencing a real adventure. 2 of the Aussie husbands, big men who had made their fortunes as partners in a construction firm, teased their wives and cracked sarcastic jokes to keep everyone's spirits up. They seemed as unconcerned as if they were waiting to board a plane. They were all good people in their twilight years, Maeve thought. It would be a shame, no, a crime, if they were to all die in that icy hellhole. Her mind wandered, and she vaguely envisioned them all interred under the rocks with the Norwegian explorers and the British whalers. A delusion, she reminded herself firmly. Despite the fact that her father and sisters were violently hostile toward her, she could not bring herself to believe they would deny her proper burial in the family plot where her ancestors rested. And yet she knew it was a distinct possibility that her family would no longer admit that Maeve was of their own flesh and blood, not after the birth of her twin boys. She lay there, staring at the fog that formed in the cavern from the heavy, concentrated breathing, and tried to picture her sons, now only 6 years old, watched over by friends while she earned badly needed money with the cruise line. What would become of them if she died? She prayed that her father would never get his hands on them. Compassion never entered into his reckonings. People's lives mattered little to him. Nor was money a driving force. He considered it merely a tool. Power to manipulate, that was his passion. Maeve's two sisters shared their father's callousness toward others. Fortunately, she took after her mother, a gentle lady who was driven to suicide by her cold and abusive husband when Maeve was 12. After the tragedy, Maeve never considered herself part of the family. None of them had forgiven her for leaving the fold and striking out on her own under a new name with nothing but the clothes on her back. It was a decision she had never regretted. She awakened, listening for a sound, or rather the lack of it. The wind was no longer whistling into the tunnel from outside. The storm was still brewing, but there was a temporary break in the frigid wind. She returned and roused the two Australian contractors. "I need you to accompany me to the penguin rookery," she told them. "They are not hard to capture. I'm breaking the law, but if we are to stay healthy until the ship returns, we must put nourishment in our stomachs." "What do you think, mate?" boomed one of the men. "I could use a taste of bird," replied the other. "Penguins aren't candidates for gourmet dining," Maeve said, smiling. "Their meat is oily, but at least it's filling." Before they left for the rookery, she prodded the others to their feet and sent them to steal wood from the whaling station to build a fire. "In for a penny, in for a pound. If I'm going to jail for killing protected creatures and destroying historic property, I might as well do a thorough job of it." They made for the rookery, which was about 2 kilometers around the point encircling the north part of the bay. Though the wind had died, the sleet made their way miserable. They could hardly see more than 3 meters in front of them. It was as though they were looking at everything through a sheet of water. Sight was even more difficult without goggles. They were wearing only sunglasses, and the drifting sleet blew in around the rims of the lenses and caked their eyelashes. Only by keeping close to the edge of the water did they maintain a sense of direction. They added 20 minutes to the hike by not walking across the point as the crow flies, but at least the detour prevented them from becoming lost. The wind howled in again, biting into their exposed faces. The thought of them all trekking to the Argentinian research station crossed Maeve's mind, but she quickly dismissed it. Few would survive the 30-kilometer journey through the storm. Better than half the aged tourists would quickly perish along the way. Maeve had to consider all prospects, the feasible and the impractical. She might make it. She was young and strong. But she could not bring herself to desert the people who were depending on her. Sending the big Aussie men who trudged beside her was a possibility. The nagging problem, as she saw it, was what would they find when they arrived? What if the Argentinian scientists had died under the same mysterious circumstances as the members of her own party? If the worst had occurred, then the only hard incentive for reaching the station was to use their powerful communications equipment. The decision was agonizing. Should she risk the two Australians' lives in a hazardous trek, or keep them at hand to help her care for the old and the weak? She decided against going for the research station. Her job did not involve putting the passengers of Ruppert and Saunders in life-threatening situations. It seemed inconceivable that they had been abandoned. They had no choice but wait it out until rescue came, from whatever source, and exist the best way they could until then. The sleet had slackened, and their vision increased to nearly 50 meters. Overhead, the sun appeared as a dim orange ball with a halo of varied colors like a round prism. They rounded the spur of rock encompassing the bay and curved back to the shoreline containing the penguin rookery. Maeve did not relish the thought of killing penguins, even as a means to stay alive. They were such tame and friendly creatures. The Pygocellus adeliae, or adelie penguins, are one of 17 true species. They sport a black feathered back and hooded head, and a white breast, and stare through beady little eyes. As suggested by fossils found on Seymour Island, their ancestors evolved more than 40 million years ago and were as tall as a man. Attracted to their almost human social behavior patterns, Maeve had spent one whole summer observing and studying a rookery and had begun a love affair with this most delightful of birds. In contrast with the larger emperor penguin, the adelies can move as fast as 5 kilometers an hour, and often faster when tobogganing over the ice on their chests. Give them a funny little derby and a cane to swing, she often mused, and they could have waddled along in a perfect imitation of Charlie Chaplin. I believe the bloody sleet is slackening, said one of the men. He was wearing a leather cap and puffing on a cigarette. About damn time, muttered the other, who had used a scarf to wrap his head, turban-style. I feel like a damp rag. They could clearly see out to sea for nearly 0.5 kilometer. The once glass-like sea was now a turmoil of white caps agitated by the wind. Maeve turned her attention to the rookery. As far as she could see was a carpet of penguins, over 50,000 of them. As she and the Aussies walked closer, it struck her as odd that none of the birds stood on their little feet, tail feathers extended as props to keep from falling over backward. They were scattered all about, most lying on their backs as if they had toppled over. Something's not right, she said. None are standing. No fool those birds, said the man in the turban. They know better than to stand against blowing sleet. Maeve ran to the edge of the rookery and looked down at the penguins lying on the outer edge. She was struck by the absence of sound. None moved, nor showed interest in her approach. She knelt and studied one. It lay limp on the ground, eyes staring sightless at her. Her face was stricken as she looked at the thousands of birds that showed no sign of life. She stared at 2 leopard seals, the natural predator of penguins, whose bodies washed back and forth in the small surge along the rock-strewn beach. They're all dead, she muttered in shock. Bloody hell, gasped the man in the leather cap. She's right. Not one of the little buggers is breathing. This can't be real, Maeve thought wildly. She stood absolutely still. She could not see what caused the mass death, but she could feel it. The crazy idea that every living thing in the rest of the world had died from the mysterious malady suddenly struck her mind. Is it possible we're the only ones left alive on a dead planet? She wondered in near panic. The man with the scarf turban wrapped around his head bent over and picked up a penguin. Saves us the trouble of having to slaughter them. Leave them be, Maeve shouted at him. Why? The man replied indignantly. We've all got to eat. We don't know what killed them. They might have died from some sort of plague. The man in the leather cap nodded. The little lady knows what she's talking about. Whatever disease killed these birds could do us in, too. I don't know about you, but I don't aim to be responsible for my wife's death. But it wasn't a disease, the other man argued. Not what killed those little old ladies and that sailor lad. It was more like some fluke of nature. Maeve stood her ground. I refuse to gamble with lives. Polar Queen will be back. We haven't been forgotten. If the captain is trying to give us a good scare, he's doing a damn fine job of it. He must have a good reason for not returning. Good reason or not, your company better be heavily insured, because they're going to get their ears sewed off when we get back to civilization. Maeve was in no mood to argue. She turned her back on the killing ground and set off toward the storage cavern. The two men followed, their eyes searching over a menacing sea for something that wasn't there.